The House Human Services Finance and Policy Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum, and so Representative Gander moves approval of the meeting minutes from March 5th, 2025. Are there any additions, corrections, or changes to be made to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes from March 5th, 2025, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion is approved, and the minutes from March 5th, 2025 are adopted. First on the agenda for today is House File 702 with Representative Davids. Representative Davids, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your bill.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Today I have with me Chester Fischel, who is with Eucrest Health Center in Duluth. And we have a situation that I'll basically let him explain. We have a situation where three nursing homes have had reduced funding. And like I said, I'll have the testifier explain it. But this is a very bipartisan bill. We have Representative Lee Finke, Representative Pete Johnson, and myself. The nursing homes are in our districts here. So I'll turn it over, if I could, Mr. Chairman, to Mr. Chester Fischel.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. And I do need to officially move House File 702 to be in front of the committee and to be laid over for possible inclusion. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record and present your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, first of all, thank you. I consider this an honor and privilege. My name is Chester Fischel. I am the administrator at Viewcrest Health Center in Duluth. I'm here on behalf of my care center and two others, Ling Bloomston in St. Paul and Chosen Valley Senior Living in Chatfield. We are nonprofit nursing homes that were affected by just some timing issues with the moratorium exception process. We make capital improvements to our building to enhance the lives of our residents and certain infrastructure issues. That goes through the moratorium exception process. It was a very competitive process. There's several facilities that are trying to make improvements. It goes before a committee. Once that's approved and you get approval from, I think it's DHS, you get to start your project. Once your project is complete, your rates get increased to cover the cost of those projects. Our three care centers started our projects prior to January 1 of 2020. In January 1 of 2020, legislature passed a change to the moratorium exception process, rate process, I guess. And so we started our project in 2018. The other two were in 2019. But all of the projects were completed after the January 1, 2020 change in the moratorium exception process. Due to this, we were put under the old rate system for this process, and it's significantly less financially feasible, I guess. So if our projects would have been approved after the 2020, our rates would have been a lot more to cover those costs. So last year, legislation was passed to make a correction to that. Which then it sunsets or it expires May 31st of 2026, which of course our costs for those projects don't end then. So we basically are here today, being only the three nursing homes in this kind of situation that started our processes before the 2020 change in the rate structure, and would appreciate your support in this legislation.
Thank you, Mr. Fischel, for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 702? Seeing no one, public testimony is closed. Questions for the bill author and his testifiers? Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Davids, for bringing this bill. A quick question on the rates. There's a grant program. I don't know if nonpartisan staff or someone from DHS can explain a little bit about the process for the those properties that can access the grant program to make sure they meet the qualification.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative Nuri, right, there is what we call the nursing home facility rate moratorium exception process, and periodically the legislature appropriates a certain amount of funds. It actually goes to the Department of Health, who makes this choice, but it's essentially money up front for the change in the nursing home rate when these things happen, and then each one is dealt with individually and approved, or usually approved if there's enough money, by the health department. These three are being left in their old rate rather than moving to a updated rate.
Representative Knorr.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to get that clarification, because there's that pot of money that is available to some extent for some of the property rate moratorium exception. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Knorr. Any other questions for the bill author, the topic, anything else? Seeing none, Representative Davids, final word.
Well, I would really thank this committee for taking this under consideration. They're kind of just in an area there where they just missed her, and we think that they should qualify for it also. And again, it's Representative Finke, Pete Johnson, and myself, they're affected by this, so it's not like we're opening up the whole gate to everybody. It's just these three that kind of got caught. I don't think they got caught. They got caught in the middle, I guess.
Victim of the calendar. With that, Representative Davids, I will lay House File 702 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members.
Thank you. Next, thank you. House File 958, Representative Nadeau. As he makes his way forward to get settled in, I will move that House File 958 be laid over for possible inclusion in an upcoming omnibus bill. Welcome to the committee, Representative Nadeau. Whenever you are ready, please introduce yourself and introduce your bill.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you. Thanks for hearing this bill today. Minnesota struggles with a mental health and substance use crisis that affects individuals across all ages and all communities. As of February 2021, 37% of Minnesotans experience symptoms of anxiety or depression. 25% of women nationally are on antidepressants, and 80% of Minnesota counties qualify as mental health professional shortage areas. About three-quarters of Minnesotans in need of mental health care don't receive effective treatment. House File 958 stands to make a significant impact on the mental health care in Minnesota, making a collaborative care model a reimbursable Medicaid benefit in our state. Collaborative care is an integrated, highly effective, and well-researched approach to performing early screening and monitoring of an individual's mental health needs in the primary care setting. It involves various health practitioners, including primary care physicians, behavioral health clinicians, and psychiatric specialists, working together to treat the patient as a whole person. The goal is to improve patient outcomes, reduce costs, and empower patients and their families. Every $1 that's spent on collaborative care saves $6.50 in reduced health care costs and improved productivity. What this language does is allow specific providers to bill Medicaid using collaborative care codes, establishes a sustainable reimbursement rate, and allocates minimum one-time funding for startup and training costs. Collaborative care is not just a theoretical concept. It's a proven, evidence-based solution that's currently covered by Medicare and nearly all commercial payers, with 37 states already offering it as a Medicaid benefit. In closing, the collaborative care model represents a transformative step towards comprehensive mental health care. The benefits are clear: improved mental health outcomes, cost savings, and sustainable reimbursement rates that attract and retain providers. With that, I want to turn it over to my testifiers.
Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frank Jadwin. I'm a clinical social worker by training, and I support the integrated behavioral health efforts at Hennepin Healthcare under the collaborative care model as their program manager. And I'm honored today to present to you an overview of the collaborative care model, an innovative care model with efficacy demonstrated in around 100 randomized controlled trials to be an effective intervention across diverse diagnoses, patient populations, and treatment settings. The collaborative care model has designated billing codes that are reimbursed by Medicare and most commercial insurance and Medicaid plans in 37 states. Our hope is to make Minnesota the 38th state to recognize these services as a Medicaid benefit. The collaborative care model is a team-based approach that integrates behavioral health services, meaning mental health and substance use treatment, into the primary care settings. And it decreases total costs of care by means of things like reduced time in the emergency department or time in the hospital. A study completed by Kaiser Permanente put those savings around 13%. The collaborative care model improves the care and outcomes for patients experiencing behavioral health conditions by fostering close communication and coordination among healthcare providers, including the primary care provider, a behavioral health clinician, and a consulting psychiatrist. It does this with the assistance of a registry tool that monitors and tracks a patient's progress. The collaborative care model differs significantly from traditional mental health services in its integration and accessibility. In traditional models, behavioral health services are often siloed from primary care, meaning that patients must seek out treatment separately and in specialized areas. This can create barriers such as long wait times, stigma, and limited access to these behavioral health providers, especially in underserved areas. We know that the majority of referrals from primary care to specialty mental health and substance use treatment do not materialize, and we know that primary care providers prescribe the largest portion of mental health medications. The collaborative care model embraces this reality and offers an enhancement by constructing a multidisciplinary team working together to coordinate care. The collaborative care model embeds a mental health professional within the primary care team. Instead of referring patients to external specialists, primary care providers collaborate directly with experts on their own team. This enables timely treatment and allows for coordinated care for both physical and behavioral health conditions. Research shows that this approach is about twice as effective as usual care. In the model, a patient can expect more frequent but brief interactions with their behavioral health care manager. This allows them to focus on specific treatment goals with higher levels of accountability. The behavioral health care manager also meets weekly with a consulting psychiatrist outside of a patient visit to discuss treatment plans, clarify diagnostic questions, and to make medication recommendations when appropriate. These recommendations are then given back to the primary care provider, who is the prescriber in this situation, supporting their practice with the time, energy, and expertise of these other professionals. The last component of the care model is this registry tool. It tracks patients and their progress, helps inform treatment, and incorporates another proven approach, measurement-based care. It tells the team if what they're doing is helping the patient get back on track, and if not, it prompts a discussion about adjusting the care plan. This model has shown significant success in improving patient outcomes, reducing healthcare costs, and increasing the overall quality of care. It also delivers care more effectively, allowing people with mild to moderate mental health and substance use issues to be treated in primary care and maintaining that access in those specialty care areas for more severe presentations, people who could benefit from more process-oriented approaches, or those needing a higher level of care. Thank you.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and present your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Cassandra Sano Hansen. I am a clinical social worker by training and the behavioral health access manager for CentraCare. CentraCare is a health system, a rural healthcare system located to the north and west of this metro area. I have provided some handouts that illustrate the state's psychiatric needs, both current and anticipated. According to the Health Resources and Services Administration, or HRSA, Minnesota currently has a 62% of what we need for adult psychiatrists, or 610 out of the needed 990 psychiatrists, and 63% of what we need for child and adolescent psychiatrists. By 2037, we anticipate our adult psychiatric workforce to decrease, while the demand for services will continue to increase, leaving us at 40% of what we need. That would just be 550 psychiatrists when we are projected to need 1380. Those numbers are looking at care as usual, so doing what we're doing now. Although we expect a modest increase in child and adolescent psychiatrists, the demand will also outpace, and we anticipate that we'll be at 56% adequate by 2037. And so these are statewide projections looking at the whole state. We know that our providers are not evenly distributed throughout the state, and 80% of our counties are designated as health provider shortage areas for mental health. The final handout is based on the number of licensed providers by zip code and population to provider ratios. When it comes to psychiatry, three of our six regions currently have population to provider ratios that are more than 1.5 times worse than the statewide total. Specifically, for the entire state, we have one psychiatrist for every 8,000 patients. But when we look closer at the central region, where my office is located, we have approximately one psychiatrist for every 21,000 patients. And when we look at the Northwest and Southwest regions, they're following closely behind and are nearly tied for second. So I anticipate that CentraCare will see a 50% decrease in psychiatrist FTEs in the next 5 to 7 years. And even though we're collaborating with the University of Minnesota to build a new medical school and expand our psychiatric residency program, we will not be able to train enough new psychiatrists to close the gap on the current anticipated future needs if we're doing care as usual. For rural healthcare, the collaborative care model isn't just innovative thing. It's not just improving what we're doing or meeting our best contemporary standards of mental health care. It's really a necessity for us. It's our lifeline. It's our hope for meeting our community's needs. Thank you.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House File 958? Seeing no one, public testimony is now closed. Questions for the bill author and the testifiers for House File 958?
There's always questions.
Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to start with Section 2, the appropriation. There's a blank appropriation to the Commission of Human Services. I thought based on the new legislation that we passed, 16B.981, that is automatically included whenever we appropriate funds. So just wanted to check in with nonpartisan staff, maybe help correct a little bit and remove that .. by just removing a small section of that.
Mr. Berg.
Mr. Chair, Representative Knorr, that's just an oversight. It certainly should say the general fund.
Representative Knorr.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to see if we can just make an oral amendment to the bill so that we can put it in the shape that can help us.
Ms. Sunderman.
Mr. Chair, members, Mr. Chair, if you're going to accept an oral amendment, we can do that. The oral amendment would be page 4, line 15, delete, I guess it's 7 dots, and insert general.
Does everybody have that? All right, are there any questions to the oral amendment? Seeing none, Ms. Henderman, could you please repeat it one more time for the record?
Mr. Chair, members, the oral amendment would be page 4, line 15, delete ... and insert general.
All right. All in favor of the oral amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, say nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Knorr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Doe. I think this is a great model to think about the holistic approach of addressing mental health and physical health. So I think this is a good bill to look into. Thank you so much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further discussion? Closing piece, Representative Nadeau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members. The collaborative care model does improve mental health access to mental health care. It improves mental health conditions, lowers costs across large groups of individuals. It serves as a force multiplier for psychiatric care, especially in under-resourced areas where there are a limited number of specialized psychiatric services. I do want to point out in your packet, there is a handout in there that shows the summary of the key differences in how the collaborative care model compares to our traditional mental health therapy, just to give you a little bit further information on that. So I appreciate the time, and I will renew the motion.
You cannot.
I can't?
Stop. Please.
Thanks.
With that, I will take House File 958 as amended, and it is now laid over.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Nadeau. Finally for today, House File 688, Representative Frazier.
You can.
I will move that House File 688 be before us to be laid over for possible inclusion in a future omnibus bill.
Oh, this is that chair. Huh? I know they're training right now. They're getting ready to change lives.
We're gonna lay it over. I mean,
yeah. Mr. Chair, if I may, what motion do we have in front of us for this bill?
Representative Frazier, the motion was to lay it over. We're currently discussing if we should change that to move it to the floor.
I would like that.
I'm feeling generous today.
There's no dog today, though, and so I don't know what's
there. Oh, there is.
If you would oblige.
So I will move that House File 688 be re-referred to the General Register. Representative Frazier, when you are ready.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, leads and committee members, for allowing me the time to discuss this bill today. House File 688 is pretty straightforward and simple. CANDU Canines is an organization that trains service dogs, and it sits within my district in the city of New Hope. We depend on thousands of volunteers a year to help us train the service dogs that will then be put with their owners and help with life-saving and critical services for those individuals. If you've ever seen someone with a service dog and you've seen the way that they interact, it's not a pet, but it's someone that provides services to that individual and helps them live out a life to the fullest potential, and they can't do it without those dogs. This bill allows for thousands of volunteers that would like to help train and socialize service dogs to have the opportunity to do so. Currently, homeowners associations are allowed to prohibit or put great restrictions on the size of dogs, the size of pets, or restrict them altogether. So that eliminates thousands of volunteers from having the opportunity to help train these dogs. This bill is pretty straightforward. It allows for homeowners or requires homeowners associations to provide for accommodations to allow those service dogs while in training to have access to the homes of those volunteers. So that's it. It's pretty straightforward. It's looking to give us access to a pool of thousands of other volunteers to help train these dogs to do so much great work with their owners. I'll stand for any questions.
Thank you.
We do have someone here from CANDU Canine if there are questions specifically for the organization, but we do not have an actual service dog here today, and I'm sorry about that. Do we? Oh, we do. I didn't see over there. All right. Is that Nova? We do have Nova here for those that would like to see a service dog in action.
If you could please make your way forward.
Thanks for being here.
Welcome to the committee. If you could please introduce yourself for the record, and if you have any testimony, otherwise introduce your service animal there.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Emily Hedenland. I am the lead program trainer at Can Do Canines, so I work with our dogs when they are in for final training about ready for client placement. And today with me I have Nova. She is one of our final training dogs, as we call them, and she is a three-year-old black lab who is getting ready to meet her client match as a mobility assistance dog.
All right. Questions for the testifiers? Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So just for me, I'd love a little context. Has this bill ever been brought before us in the past?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Gilman, no, it has not been brought before us in the past, to my knowledge.
Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair. And then just a little follow-up on that. Has there been resistance with the HOAs and landlords because there's been legal disputes in the past in regards to having pets? Or not pets, service dogs, any animals?
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. And Representative Gilman, I am not sure of any resistance because of legal disputes, but the bill clearly provides that individuals, if they're providing space for these service dogs, if there's any damage that is caused, they will be responsible for that damage.
Okay. Representative Gilman.
Thank you, Chair.
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've spent the last 25 years in residential rental property ownership and management. And we've had plenty of cases where folks have brought in a pet that was unauthorized, and we say, well, what's this pet? Well, lo and behold, a week or two later, they come back with a note from a physician that says it's a companion animal. And that, to me, is upside down. Hmm. So I guess I would ask if, by the way, the provision whereby they pay for damages, that's, of course, a good thing. Thanks for putting that in there. Hmm. And I know you also have the provision that they will provide certification as being a trainer of these service animals. And I guess I would ask that you preempt any concern from the landlord and provide that right up front, right? If you're going to come in and say, I'm going to be training service animals, and just go to your property owner, manager, and say, here it is. I'm coming in. I'm not going to, like, ask for forgiveness later. Of course, they wouldn't be. They would be authorized from day one to do it. But I think it would be way better for the dynamic. I would actually get in behind it and support it. If you say, I'm going to start training service animals, and I'm going to do it in my apartment, and I would like to show you my authorization to do that. Give them the paperwork up front, not waiting for the landlord to have to request it. I would much rather see that. To me, it would be better for your program, better for the property owner.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for that input. This only covers properties that are covered by HOA. So if it's a rental property, that wouldn't be the same thing, and this wouldn't apply to that. Does that address the issue that you were?
Representative Gander.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It sure does address it, and I guess it could extend also to rental property.
Representative Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, but this bill does not.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Representative Backer.
Yeah, this is more for the testifier. How do you determine where you place the dog? What type of parameters do you set up in place to try to get a match for the right person?
And could you please state your name again? I missed it. I got Nova, but I didn't get yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Emily Hedenland. And as far as our matching process goes, so we have these dogs from the time they're born typically. So we have a great understanding by the time they are ready for client placement, what the dog has experienced, what kind of lifestyle it has grown up in, and other things that may make it compatible for the client. And then on our client end, we have an entire department dedicated to receiving applications. There's quite a lengthy application process. After that application has been accepted, there is an in-person interview with not only the applicant, but those in their home as well. From there, if they are accepted into our program, my department works with our client services department to make the best match that we can, not only career-wise and skill-wise for the dog and the client, but also personality, temperament, and lifestyle match as well. It's a little bit of an art rather than a science.
Representative Backer.
Yeah, thank you. Follow-up. So once the service dog is placed, what type of follow-up do you do to, obviously, to make sure that there is still a match after that and, you know, the service dog is being properly cared for?
Ms. Hedeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, so initially when the dog moves into the home, we have about a 6 to 8 week period where they will work with trainers either weekly or biweekly. They then are certified by our accrediting member, Assistance Dogs International. From there, they do have to submit monthly for the first 6 months a survey, including the dog's weight, any training concerns, how things are going. From there, that survey becomes annual, where they are also required to submit vet records. And then we do have a graduate services department that offers any follow-up training for the lifetime of the dog, not only training, but if any life instances occurs, any change in the client's lifestyle, anything that they need, we support the client through the lifetime of the team.
Representative Backer.
Thank you. So on the average, how long will that one service dog stay with the client? Are we talking about the life of the service dog, generally speaking, or that's my question. Thank you.
Ms. Hedeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, so it depends on each individual dog. We like to say they will tell us when they retire, but usually about 8 to 10 years is pretty typical. Some clients will then keep the dog in their home when they are retired, or if they are unable to care for maybe a senior or aging dog. Usually a family member by that time has spent the last 8 to 10 years seeing this dog regularly and will welcome them into their home. So about 8 to 10 years.
Okay. Representative Backer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So on the average, how many service dogs does your organization put into the marketplace helping other individuals with the disability?
Ms. Hedeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We currently do between 40 and about 55 dogs per year. It does vary a little bit from year to year. And to date, in our over 35 years, we've done over 900 teams total.
Okay. Representative Backer.
Thank you. No further follow-up. Appreciate that.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you, Chair Schumacher. So just so I understand completely, this will essentially treat a service a service animal in training the exact same as a service animal. Is that the proper understanding of it?
That is correct.
Representative Frazier. Okay.
And only
sorry, Mr. Chair, thank you.
And at this point, only for HOAs and not general rentals?
That is correct.
Frazier.
Mr. Chair.
So my concern for landlords into the future, many of these companion animals, doctors prescribe those. Landlords are required to take them whether they want them or not. Do you see this as a potential stepping stone to bring in, once this is secured, to bring in then those companion animals and extend it from from HOAs into general rentals? Is this like the first step towards the bigger end of the picture?
Representative Frazier.
Mr. Chair, thank you. No, this is not what this is intended for. I'm glad you brought this up because I wanted to make up the point. I have heard some feedback from individuals, and Representative Hicks has provided me for information as well, with folks that have disabilities that are concerned that this will have an impact on this. This is not intended to impact the ADA requirements at all. And the situation you're talking about, I believe, would be covered under the ADA. That's federal law, and they're required to provide those accommodations. So if it's a companion dog based on that, but this bill does not address that at all. And this is not intended to open up the door for that.
Representative Jacob.
Thank you.
Representative Hicks.
Hi. Thank you so much, Chair. So as somebody that's done a lot of work with people with disabilities, I think our testifiers can probably answer this question, but maybe for clarification on the record, could someone please explain the difference between an emotional support animal and a service dog?
Yes.
Ms. Hedeland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So currently what we train are what we consider assistance dogs or service dogs. So these are dogs that are task trained to mitigate a handler's disability. We say it kind of evens the playing field. So while I may be easily able to bend over and pick up something that I've dropped, someone with a disability may not be able to do so, or it may be unsafe for them to do so. So we are providing dogs that are trained to do those everyday tasks that make life safe and level the playing field for them. An emotional support animal, however, does not require any training. They do require a physician's note, and they do not have to be a dog. These are not animals that we place, train, or have anything to do with. We only currently train and place assistance dogs that have gone through extensive task training.
Representative Hicks.
Thank you so much for that. I do appreciate it because in the disability world, we really do struggle a little bit with the difference and helping people understand the difference and the rights that people get with the different things, right? So service animals get different public accommodation rates outside of home ownership. And it's really, or HOAs or apartments or any of that, like community space. And so I think it's really important that we understand the difference. To the bill author, though, I would still like to have a conversation about a couple of things later off the record.
Okay.
Thank you, Representative Hicks. Any other questions for the testifiers, for the bill author? Seeing none, Ms. Hedeland, thank you for the work that you do and for coming and testifying today. Obviously, your work has prepared you well for us. Final words, Representative Frazier.
Well, it's a good bill. We're trying to make sure we can increase the pool of volunteers to ensure that we can get the service dog trained and get them to their owners to help them live their lives the best they can.
Thank you. With that, I will renew my motion that House File 688 be re-referred to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. The motion passes, and House File 688 is re-referred to the General Register. With that, we have no further business. Our next hearing will be Tuesday, March 11th, 2025. We get to be here at 8:15 for a budget forecast overview.
Ooh. Thank you.
With that, we are adjourned.